I'm very glad now to be able to introduce our guest, Billy Crystal, who you probably know as the star of Soap. He plays the part of Jody. He's also, I can tell you, a very excellent comic. Perhaps you know that for yourself from having seen him at the Bijou, where he'll continue to be through Saturday, or from having seen him on Dinah or the Merv Griffin Show or the Tonight Show. He's in Philadelphia to be performing at the Bijou, and it's a great coincidence also to have him here, because as I mentioned before, when Milt Gabler of Commodore Records and the Commodore Record Shop was here a couple of weeks ago, we spent a good deal of time off the air talking about Billy Crystal. So, of course, as soon as I found out he was going to be in town, I very much wanted for him to join us, and I'm very pleased to say welcome to you, Billy Crystal. It's
Thanks.
A great pleasure to have you
It's
here.
Great to be here.
There's a lot of things we'll want to be talking about for the next while, but I'd like to start by talking about some of your childhood experiences with some really great jazz musicians through your father's work, Jack Crystal, who mm-hmm. was a jazz producer and who worked with Milt Gabler running mm-hmm. the Commodore Record Shop. Were you like... Billie Holiday used to babysit for you. That I really want to hear about.
There was one occasion that I remember tremendously that... My dad used to produce concerts in a place called the Central Plaza in New York, which was on 2nd Avenue, which later became an NYU building. And next door there was a rundown movie theater, which later became a slightly famous place called the Fillmore East. And at that time it was a low state movie theater, Lowy's or whatever. And Billy was down watching some of the guys work. Roy Eldridge, I remember, was there, and Eddie Condon and Wild Bill Davis. And I remember that vividly, being backstage watching them put away quarts and quarts of gin. And she said, "Let's go to movies." So I was 5 years old, and she grabbed me by the hand, and I remember seeing Shane with Alan Ladd and Brandon DeWilder. And Brandon's crying as Shane rides off into the distance. "Come back, Shane. My mom wants you. Come back, Shane," you know. And she was crying, and I said, "Come on." You know, I remember saying to her, what's so sad? She goes, "Oh, look at that little face on that kid," you know. And that was one of my strong remembrances ever. She spent like 3 hours with me just keeping me quiet because I was bugging the musicians, you know, because I wanted to dance with them. You know, I wanted to dance in front of them.
Did you have any sense? Did you have any sense of her stature as a musician?
No, I didn't know it until, maybe 5 or 6 years after she passed away, what she was, you know, and what she meant to the industry, you know, and to the world. I had no idea. She was one of my father's friends, you know. She was one of my uncle's, friends, you know. As far as I knew, she worked for my uncle, you know, because he produced her so many times on albums, you know. I had no idea who any of those people were. Billy was perhaps the most universally famous, but the other guys, Willie the Lion Smith, Condon, Zooty Singleton, Tyree Glenn, Miff Mole, Big Chief Russell Moore, who was an American Indian, he weighed about 400 pounds, played trombone, was one of my favorites. I would sit on his lap, or what approximated his lap, and listen to hours and hours of story about learning to play jazz on a reservation. I mean, these guys had such incredible stories. One of the great players, one of the more exciting players, is a guy a lot of people know for something that is weird. His name is Conrad Janis. And Connie now plays the father on Mork and Mindy, plays Mindy's father in a music store, the Ball Fella. Well, Connie was a great tailgate trombone player. He had a group called Conrad Janis and the Tailgaters. And he was, at the time, more exciting than Elvis. I mean, he was all over the stage with a trombone, which is an assaulting kind of instrument because it's always being pushed towards you. And he would jump up on a piano, and 12th Street Reg was all over the place. And he was wild. And he would get me out, and I was 5 or 6, and I would tap dance in front of him, in front of the band at these big concerts, with one leg because I couldn't get the other leg going. Just the right leg tapping wildly and the left leg going, "I can't do this."
Were the musicians all really protective towards you since you were, you know, the young, cute little kid?
Yeah, I was. That was my nickname was Face. And Willie the Lion, who was a great piano player and an extraordinary man, he got the name because he was in World War I. He was at the front line for a long time. He was unique in that his mother had worked as a maid for Yiddish-speaking people in the Lower East Side, and Willie would spend a lot of time, you know, with his mother with his family, and he spoke fluent Yiddish. So he would call up my dad, seeing if there was a gig that week that he could play, and I'd answer the phone. I'd go, "Hello, is it Face? Yeah, Vishmaks, I mean, if I was having to do a whole thing with Yiddish. And, oh, he was a wonderful character. They all had something different.
Were you listening to their music then? I mean, were you at all involved with that?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, I was listening to everybody then, you know, because of the music store, we got records for free. You know, Dad would bring home all different kinds of things. And I loved Dixieland from the time I was a little kid until now. I mean, I love to hear it. It's soulful, it's real, and it's exciting or it's sad. I mean, it's a lot of different things.
A friend of mine who saw you do Face on television talked about what a surprise it was to hear someone on TV talking about Ben Webster in the middle of a comic routine. It's not something that you see, or it's not something that you hear very much.
Well,
I mean, there are people who tend to not be acknowledged much on television or acknowledged much by, you know, people on stages.
Right? Yeah, I think a lot of the things I do are not normally done by most comics. References, or, you know, some are, some aren't, but they're real stories. They're true stories, you know.
What's some of the advice you were given when you were young?
Well, a lot of it is what I put into Face, you know. Pee Wee Russell told me, never play the clarinet again.
Is that the way you were playing?
Yeah, don't play. Talk, don't play. Just never stop doing what you, if you want to do something, do it. I mean, these guys had lived in the back of cars. You know, they lived on buses, and they had been beaten down. The only good time they had all day was when they played. And they were basically happy people, you know, and that they loved their music. But for a lot of them, that was all they had. And that's why when they played the blues, they played the blues. You know, it really was just, that's why I found it so moving. I think at an early age, I was very aware of how personal that was to them.
That they didn't pass on to you a sense of bitterness for the recognition that they didn't get, or for the money that they didn't get during their life.
No, because they loved that music, you know, and for me, that's why I try to get through in doing the piece and doing Face on stage, is that I personally don't care how much money I make. I like doing my work. I mean, if I was to come in and be solely concerned with money, I wouldn't be playing the Bijou. I mean, you know, quite honestly, you know, I mean, I love the room, and it's a great room. It's a terrific room to see someone, but I would do one night at the Academy, you know, or something. And maybe you could make more money, but that's not important to me. The work is what's important.
I could really sense that.
You know, I really love being on stage and creating. And last night in the second show, someone yelled out, "Boy, do you work hard." and it was a great compliment. I did an hour and 45 minutes the second show, and did an hour the first show.
Well, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the work that you're doing now, and what it was like to be opening for other people before your name became as well known as it is now.
Okay, but I'll only do that if the phone lines light up a little bit more.
Oh, thanks, Billy. I'd really like to remind our listeners.
The numbers
to,
are. Can I do it?
Sure.
243. Now I won't finish it until someone lights up. I'm only kidding. 1, 2, 3, 4. And if you live out of that area code, it's 800?
Yeah.
228-5000. And do you get a free credit card for this call? No, that was something else.
Right.
Okay.
So those are the numbers, 243-1234. 800-228-5000.
See that? We're doing duets on public radio. It's incredible.
There
you go. Thank you.
There's nine of them. There's nine of them waiting for you. Thank you, person on the phone now. We've got $1,200 to make today. That's $400 an hour for a three-hour show. We're a long way from reaching that. I know we could do it if you just get on the phone. 243-1234 is the phone number. Our guest is Billy Crystal, who I'm sure you know as one of the stars of Soap. He's in Philadelphia performing at the Bijou. I saw him perform last night and really greatly enjoyed it, and I'm greatly looking forward to the rest of our conversation, which will begin shortly. But it's your turn now, really. 243-1234. Listen, if you listen to Fresh Air pretty regularly in the afternoons, or even irregularly for that matter, and if you value what you hear, I'm really asking you to let us know about it, because we need some kind of like tangible evidence, and we also need your monetary support to keep these things going. Fresh Air is not a cheap show to produce. And I hope it doesn't sound that way either. There's a staff on it. There's myself. There's Danny Miller. There's the people who contribute to the show. It takes a lot of time and a lot of energy to put the show together. We need your support to keep this kind of operation going. Where are you now? 243-1234. Go to your phone, please, and give us a call. We really need to hear from you. I know the weather's nice today, but that doesn't make your phone inoperable. Your phone, I'm sure, still works just fine. If you're at work, no one is going... Well, how do I know?
There you go.
If you're at work now, chances are you could probably, you know, make one call and give us a call now. Probably it won't really be, you know, risking a lot to do that. If you listen at work and if it helps make your working day easier to have fresh air on, why don't you let us know about it? Give us a call. Give us your comments. Tell us what you think about the show. And if you can, give us a pledge, too. We really do need it. 243-1234.
And if you've just been picked up by the police and you have one phone call to make, then we'll be waiting for you to hear from you here. And we'll pass on a message or whatever you want. Yesterday, I mentioned that going around the country listening to other public radio stations, there really is absolutely nothing, any place that's this type of show. And the listeners here in Philadelphia, boy, you don't know what you've got. Really, and this is the time to really come forward and put your money where your ears are and call 243-1234. There are operators here, volunteer operators, who are clutching pens in hand over the pledges in the other room, and they're waiting to hear from you. It's 243-1234. Outside the local area code, it's 800-228-5000, and go to the phone and call. We have thousands of empty pledge forms near the room that are waiting to get filled up.
We've got premiums for you, too. We've got the, I think that we still have one set of tickets to any season Phillies game for a $40 pledge or more. There's only one of those. So if that's the one you want, specify it. It was one pair. Mm-hmm. We've got two phones lit. We're making progress here. There's eight waiting for you, 243-1234. A number of double album premiums. If you're a little confused about what we're offering, ask the person who answers the telephone. Remember that there is a double album Billie Holiday reissue of some of her work from her later years, around 1955, 56, work in which is accompanied by Ben Webster and Jimmy Rowles. Give us a call, 243-1234.
There are a whole bunch of other premiums, non-jazz premiums of records. There are folk music record sets, several of those, several classical music sets, several old-time radio broadcast albums. There are all kinds of things that you can get for pledging amounts over and above the basic subscription amount of $20 a year, for which you receive the program guide every month, and of course you have the you receive WUHY on your radio every day as well. And so we really earnestly invite you to become part of WUHY by calling 243-1234, 243-1234, or 800-228-5000. This is really, what we're asking you to do is really invest in a growing operation, which is really becoming more and more of an important cultural force here in the Delaware Valley area. And this really is the time to do it now. There are a lot of people who call and say, gee, you know, I've meant to do this for weeks or months or years and never really got around to doing it. And, well, this is the time. We make it very easy for you. The operators will take down all the necessary information. We'll take care of all the bureaucratic nonsense that has to be taken care of. All you have to do is go to your phone and call. It's 243-1234. That's 243-1234.
I just want to remind you a little bit of some of the other special programming that we have for you for the rest of the week. Billy Crystal is with us now, and we'll be continuing our conversation in just a moment. Tomorrow afternoon, John Zwed, who reviews new jazz releases on Fresh Air, will be with us, along with Gary Giddens, who writes a regular column on jazz for the Village Voice. On Monday, Barbara Ruffo will be here with armloads of 78 RPM recordings, all kinds of things from the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Tuesday, Joan Morris and Bill Balcom will talk to us about their music, and we'll be hearing a lot of their music. And Wednesday, John Johnson will be at the piano playing the music of Harold Arlen, Jerome Kern, George and Ira Gershwin. So if that's the kind of programming you like to listen to, kind of give us a call. You think this can happen without support? Of course not. Do you think that there's lots of commercial sponsors who or commercial places where these kinds of things can happen on the air? Not right now. Maybe at some future point, but not right now. It's your support that keeps that kind of programming going, and it's your support that allows us to support the kinds of things that we do. 243-1234 is the phone number. I'd like to reintroduce my guest, Billy Crystal, who you probably know as the star of Soap.
Boy, that's good cheesecake. Whose cheesecake is that? It's Barry Katz? Is that his name?
Yeah, that's coming up a little later, actually. Oh. That'll be in the next hour, that good cheesecake.
Supposed to be under wraps.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're holding it.
Good cheesecake. If you call in a pledge of $10 or more, we'll send you a piece of that cheesecake.
Let's see, I'd like to...
by return mail.
Send them plain brown folder.
I'll tell you how confused I'm getting, but that's your fault for not calling at 243-1234. Billy Crystal is our guest, and he's in Philadelphia to perform at the Bijou through Saturday. Let's talk a little bit about how you first started getting involved in comedy. I know you went to NYU in film school there.
Right.
And I'd love to hear about how you decided that you were going to start doing your own material and writing it.
I really had started, I'm being quite honest, when I was about 6 years old, miming records. I think everyone does that. Spike Jones was the big thing. Everyone, you know, but it was a natural thing, and I thought I was the only one in the world who did it. Now that I meet fellow comics, oh, yeah, I did that too. You know, we all were the same craziness, you know, pervaded. And I started doing my own stuff. I came from an era, the shopping what it was, and having access to a lot of records. That was an era of album comedy. All at once, all these, boy, talk about comedy albums doing well all at once. We had Shelley Berman. That was a great album. The Button Down Mind of Bob Newhart. All of Jonathan Winters' albums were classics, which I still treasure. And Nichols and May had done their Broadway show, and their album was An Evening with Nichols and May that Arthur Penn directed.
He did.
He directed their stage show. My God, Bob and Ray I would listen to. So it was an era. The original 2,000-Year-Old Man album came along in that period of time.
Jose Jimenez.
Yes, I used to do Jose Jimenez with my older brother.
Really?
My name, Jose Jimenez. Oh, the whole thing we used to do. That's when it started. My older brother and I were foils for each other. We were a young Abbott and Costello, you know. And so it started then. I would get up and perform, and especially with the musicians. I tap danced huge concerts that I think back on.
There's a period, I think, in, maybe the late 60s where there weren't many comedians and where I assume that many people weren't thinking in terms of becoming comedians.
In the late 60s?
Late 60s, early 70s, maybe.
It was sort of a generation gap, Phil.
It was a weird time. It was a very weird time.
I guess that was right before you really became a professional yourself.
Yeah, I started in 70 with a group, with an improvisational group. A lot of guys had burned out, you know. A lot of guys had faded. Those guys I just talked about had faded, you know. Berman had faded. Jonathan stopped performing live and disastrously got into television where they try to write for him, you know. No one could write for him.
And movies, which was even more of a disaster.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he was such a free spirit, and they try to put lassos on him, and you can't do that. And Newhart did the Vegas route, you know, and had done that kind of thing. And so we were, and Lenny was in the whole court thing and eventually died. So there was the only one who was really working was Cosby, I think, was the big hot thing then. And Carlin was then a very commercial comic and had not gone through his change. And it was there was a lack there. You know, Dick Gregory was getting angry and was getting political and starving himself and running cross-country every other week, you know? So we were missing funny people, you know?
Well, what was your early material built around when you're doing improvisational work with a group?
With a group,
of three
yeah.
Others,
two other guys. There were three of us. We actually played the Bijou a couple of times. What was the basis of our stuff?
What were some of the kinds of things in your material, of things that you used within your material?
Well, I think we were into nostalgia before a lot of people. Well, we used to do a takeoff of American Bandstand, the old Dick Clark show. I would play Dick, and we had the two guys on Rate the Record and moronic people. And
that used to be done here, you know, out of these studios.
Oh, sure.
American Bandstand.
Oh, right out of here?
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy.
That's right. Dick Clark's ghost is rumored to
still be looking young.
He's come back every so often, both to do specials. He was recently on the corner, right down the block, just filming a couple of shots for one of the specials.
He's a nice man. And we would do that. At that time, it was dope was first becoming big, and we did a thing on the first marijuana commercial and stuff like that. We were okay, but we stayed together too long, you know, and without breaking through, and it's real lonely at the middle. So about 3.5 years ago, I quit to work out on my own, you know.
Well, when you were working on your own, you must have found yourself opening for a lot of people.
I've opened for maybe more diverse people in this business than any other comic, you know, I think. I mean, from Patti Smith to Billy Joel to Manilow to Sedaka to Melissa Manchester and Carnegie Hall to, I mean, just, I can go on and on and on of, to Shanana to,
Would you do the same material for each of these audiences?
Basically, I would change certain references, you know, or I would leave out certain hipper remarks that I felt were a little, you know, more selective. You don't really do much about, say, drugs or politics when you have an audience of blue hairs, you know, or beehive hairdos. You know, you change and you do certain things, more commercial things, you know. But my range then was I would go for anybody. You know, I would open for anybody because it was important. It was growing times. I played a lot of Playboy clubs. Didn't want to, but they were valuable because I was playing to leisure suits and white shoes, and I learned that, ooh, I can play that too, you know. So I've had a real well-rounded background in my short stint as a stand-up, you know.
One of the really wonderful things about your act are the two set pieces you do, the Muhammad Ali piece and the face piece, and are very effective and they're very moving and poignant. Is that something that that generally works on audiences, or do you really have to gauge what kind of audience to do that with?
No, it generally works.
Because it's not the sort of thing that you'd, you know,
used to sing in a club. Yeah, and that's why it works, because it's sort of, wow, what a, you know, you're still laughing those pieces. There's laughter, there's warmth. But there's some sort of dimension that's different, you know, than you may see someplace else, with the exception maybe Lily, you know, I don't know. But I did Vegas just to see what it was like. And I would close with 15 rounds. I can only do 20 minutes, so I would do a quick 15 and set up and then do it, and it worked there. You know, which was weird, because you have in Vegas, you're dealing with Kansas, you're dealing with real middle America. You know, who come there, you know, this is the pleasure, this is Fantasy Island to these people. And you're talking about someone who perhaps is a threat to them, and always has been, you know, Ali, a draft evader, you know, way before his time, he was saying the right things, you know. However you feel about him, he was saying something that we all found out later to be true, you know. And they don't quite know how to respond, but at the end of it, they're uplifted, you know, it's moving to them. So I do it, you know, and I do it like I believe it. And if they don't get it, they don't get it. But at least I've done one for me, you know, so to speak, you know. But it's still for them also if they want to open up to it.
A minute ago when you were talking about different comics, it's occurred to me that there's a real break between the comics that grew up before television and the comics that grew up during television. And now among younger comics, it seems that all of the material, or a large proportion of it, is generated from, you know, hours and hours of watching, you know, Burt Parks and Billy Graham and Ed Reimers and, you know, Leave It to Beaver and My Little Margie and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's really where the experience comes from, that the comedy.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm not a big fan of the comedy of today. And being a part of it, it may be a harsh statement, I don't know, or an overly critical one. I'm not a huge fan of silliness, you know? And I'm not putting these people down. They're all wonderfully talented. I'm talking about, you know, the people who are hot today as solely stand-up. There's not much thought that goes behind that, you know? And I'm not being snobbish about my feeling about it, but I like to leave something feeling that I was part of it or feeling important, you know, like I felt something, You know, a laugh is a great release, and once it's gone, you want another one. And if you don't have another one, then you want to feel something, you know. And you can go all night and laugh at somebody and walk out and say, boy, did I laugh, and then you forget it the next day. You don't remember a word he said or something he did. And in other cases, I know I express the same feeling Lily does, and is that I'd rather sacrifice that laugh, you know, because I'll get my laughs for a feeling, for something that you will remember. I did Face on Saturday night 2 years ago, more than that, when Ron Nessen, well, when Gerald Ford was still president. Ron Nessen was his press secretary, and I did Face for the first time on Saturday night, and I still get people who stop me and remember it.
Huh. Do you, have you ever done that opening for a jazz musician in a club?
Yeah, I did an opening for Freddie Hubbard here at the Bijou. I did it for Chuck Mangione, and I came off stage, and I was opening for him, and one of the cardinal rules when you open for somebody, don't do too much time. They're there to see that person. And this was in Atlanta, and I got on a real roll, and they were really with me. I had a lot of fans there at the time. This is way before Soap or anything, and I'd played this club 3 times in a year, and they'd grown to know me, you know. And I got hot, and I was supposed to do 30, and I did 45. But there was no sense of time. It was just one of these freeing things, and they stood up at the end, you know, and I walked off stage, and Chuck was there, and I went over to apologize, you know. I said, hey, I'm really sorry. And he said, hey. He said, no problem, man. You talk jazz. And it was the nicest compliment I've ever gotten. You know, it was really, I just was one of those freewheeling things where I was improvising for, I don't know, 20 minutes, just going wild. And he dug it, and he sat there, and he knew what I was doing, you know.
That's great.
Yeah, it was a nice feeling.
I would just like to interrupt our conversation briefly and remind our listeners, Dave, that the phones have not been ringing while we were talking. We're going to continue talking in just a moment. But for the moment, please, get to your phones. Give us a call at 243-1234.
Terry's going to have to take the old kid gloves off and really start going, and then watch out.
Yeah, it's going to be live on the air brutality. But before we get brutal, let's just thank some people. Thank you, John Wright of Pennsylvania, for your pledge. And John likes classical music programming a lot. Thank you, Levittown Ortic of Pennsylvania, for your pledge. Amy Laub of Media Pennsylvania, thank you very much for your pledge. Steve Gomolka of Broomall and Suzanne Stone of Philadelphia are some of the people who've pledged during the last few minutes on Fresh Air. The Phillies tickets have been given away. Well,
I wanted to go.
Our pledge so far, the total is 171 plus the person who's right on the phone right this minute. So let's see, we're supposed to have $300 for the first hour. Not too bad. $130 more in the next 17 minutes. Easy with your help. 243-1234.
It's time to unveil our secret surprise premium, a Cat's Cheesecake. For $40, this will be yours. It will be driven up in front of your house. It's a 3 1/4 pound cheesecake from Barry Katz, who's a fan of Fresh Air. And we're going to read the recipe, but we just got a court order from the federal government that it's too dangerous to be read on the air. But we can say that they're made with all natural ingredients, no artificial flavorings or color. Comes in a variety of flavors. Plain, if that's a flavor. Cherry, blueberry, pineapple, peach, amaretto. Chocolate swirl, chocolate fudge swirl, walnut praline lemon, and special orders, which we won't get into. So for $40, this will be yours. And
We only have one.
It was incredible, too. It was one of the great cheesecakes. I know I sound funny. I love cheesecake. That was a great cheesecake, Barry.
It was really the top-of-the-line cheesecake with the trimmings.
Barry Katz, last fall when we were fundraising, he also donated to us a bunch of cheesecakes, and they went as fast as cheesecakes. What would you say? They went like hotcakes? They went like cheesecakes? They went really quick. So our phone number is 243-1234. There's 8 lines open. We're waiting for your call, 243-1234. Remember, there's a cheesecake for a $40 pledge.
And actually, the person who got the Phillies tickets should actually call back again and get the cheesecake and take it to the game, because it's much healthier than hot dogs at the game.
Oh, that's... Who is it saying?
It's all natural ingredients.
Who was saying yesterday? It was you. Oh, okay. That's right. Funny how you're the things you're saying come right back to you.
What was it? What did I say?
Oh, about how... Do you want me to say how in Los Angeles...
The Dodger vendors?
Yeah.
Boring.
Oh.
Avocado here. Hey, Karma. I've got Karma. Doesn't quite make it.
Billy Crystal is our guest, and I'm really enjoying this afternoon. Help me enjoy it a little more with your phone call, 243-1234. 243-1234 is the phone number once again. I know it's that not that you don't know the number, because we've composed enough tunes and said it enough times. Take out a minute. If you're at home now, things will probably just hold for a second as you get to the phone and call us. If you're at work, it'll just take a minute. Chances are you can do it. Perhaps you're the employer and can encourage your whole staff to give us a call. But seriously, if you're in an office or something, or if you're at work, maybe a few of you who listen to the show would like to call up and pull some money and make a joint pledge. That's fine, and we could even mention the name of your office. 243-1234 is the phone number to do that. If you're in the car, we'll be here when you get to where you're going. If you like, you can swerve right off to the nearest phone booth and put a dime in and give us a call right away. But a more preferable option might be to wait till you get to your destination. We'll be here when you get there. You can give us a call, 243-1234. Let's hear from you. Really, I'd estimate about now $100 shy of our goal of $300 for 3 o'clock. Oh, I knew something was wrong. That's the wrong goal. $300 an hour, it would be $900. Our goal is $1,200, so it's $400. We need more phone calls than I even thought.
Oops.
243-1234. Let's do it. My guest is Billy Crystal, the star of Soap. He plays Jody. And as probably everyone knows, Jody is the homosexual of the family. What are some of the kind of trips that's put you through? You know, not playing the part of a homosexual, but people often really... first of all, a lot of people don't believe that it's okay at this point to be gay. There's a lot of people who think that that's really a problem and you should go to a doctor and get the problem fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Also, a lot of people really confuse an actor's role with an actor's life and think that if you mm-hmm. act a role, that that's really the person who you are, and mm-hmm. you know that off the screen you'd be Jody as well as
right.
On the screen. So are there any like repercussions that the role has had for you?
Well, I think you've sort of named them, you know, mm-hmm. is that guilt by association kind of thing. Not that it would be wrong, you know, I don't want to cast that aspersion, but let's take the best example of all. Carol O'Connor has been one of the great American television figures for 9 years now, and he's a brilliant actor, and he's given us more laughs than Captain Video. I mean, the man has been an incredible influence on America. People think he's Archie Bunker. You know, they call him Archie when they see him. I mean, he's an incredible talent. It's a pitfall of television. We're smaller than life. You know, I mean, we're 6 inches tall, and we come in to your house. It's very informal. You sit there in your underwear, and, you know, we're all dressed and doing our show for you, you know, and it's free. And you're going, we're your friends. We're in your house, you know. It's different, I think, when you go to a movie and you pay to see somebody, then you know who it is, you know. But when you're in the house, it's like you're visiting, you know. So I think that's where that syndrome comes from. And also the repetition of once a week you're that person to them. And you're never called by your own name. I'm always on the show. It's always, of course, because I'm a character. I'm always Jody, you know. He's always Bert. He's, you know. And it's a bother because, I mean, before Soap, and it would be the same on any show. Before Soap, I was doing stand-up. I started doing a show, and I put the stand-up aside because I didn't want to do the traveling. I didn't want to hassle with the hecklers. I didn't want to wait after that first show letdown, to do the second set. You know, it's hard to get yourself emotionally geared, do an hour, come off, cool off for half hour, then do another hour, you know, the same intensity, even more so, because the later audience tends to be a little more laid back than the early audience, you know. It's difficult in that way and shaking that image. So what I've consciously done when the show wrapped for the year this year was to get out and do more personals than I did last year. I didn't do any. And so I was physically tired, you know. And this year I just wanted to get out there and say, hey, this is what I do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an actor also, but this is what I'm about, you know. So it's a total re-educational process because when I left the East, I was just getting real hot in the East on colleges and starting to build up a nice reputation, you know. Then I left and shut it off and was doing the show and couldn't get back East as much as I wanted, and dates couldn't be done because I was committed, you know, and to the show. So now when I have all this free time, I don't have to go back till July, I'm going to do as many as I can, you know.
What are your impressions of the character, Jody, who you play on Soap?
Jody is a very honest, sympathetic, but not in a sad way, positive character. He did not start out that way, which was not my doing, which was the writing. We were locked into silly sex operation and dresses and shock value kind of stuff, which was an attention getter more than anything else. And
it did get a lot of attention. Yeah. It was an amazing amount of press.
Yeah. Very difficult to play, honestly. I mean, what do I know from Sex Change Operation? You know, I mean, my God. And every time I would say it in a script, I would sort of cough, you know, the operation. I couldn't, as an actor, justify ever thinking about something like this, you know.
Well, didn't the Joan Rivers movie come out at the same time?
Yeah, and they were done at separate times, and they both hit at the same time and created this whole, I mean, I played the first pregnant man and created this whole, what is he doing?
Who is this guy?
What is this? People magazine called me the...
Oh, he must be so unhappy with his life.
Yeah, they called me the king of kink. And it was just this strange thing that they both hit at the same time, you know, but that's in the past now. It's just now on to just keep doing what I do.
Well, are you committed to the series for further seasons, or what's going on?
Yeah, we're renewed for another season. I imagine the show will probably run 5 years. I would not like to do that much because I'm...
Well, 5 years is the magic number for television.
Yeah, I would like to get out and not leave the show entirely, I don't think. I mean, that would be nice, I think, but I would like to stay and do a few and be free to do other things, you know. I miss being me too much.
We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment with our guest, Billy Crystal. We're talking now about Soap, the situation comedy that he stars on. He also does stand-up comedy, which is what he's doing now in Philadelphia, a show at the Bijou he's here to perform. First, I'd like to ask you to please give us a call at 243-1234. As I mentioned a little earlier, and as we spoke about a little earlier, Billy grew up in the company of a lot of jazz musicians, listening to a lot of records, And his father, Jack Crystal, and uncle, Milt Gabler, were involved with the Commodore Record Shop and with Commodore Records. And we're going to hear, just take a pause for a moment and hear one of the sessions that's, I think, one of Billy's favorites, and I know one of mine. And this is Lester Young and the Kansas City Six. There's going to be a vocalist on this recording, and the vocalist is rhythm guitarist Freddie Green, who was with the rhythm section of the Basie Band.
Way you're flirting with them there eyes. You make me feel so happy. You make me feel so blue. I'm falling, no stalling, falling in a great big way for you. My heart's thumping, solid jumping. Them there eyes. You better look out, babes, if you wise. Oh, wise, babe. Sparkle, the bubble, you're going to get you in a whole lot of trouble. Oh, baby, them there eyes. Thank you.
it's a good interview.
Okay. That was Them Their Eyes from the Lester Young with the Kansas City Six album. And the vocalist on that was Freddie Green. This is David Karpoff, and Terry Gross has stepped out for a moment to welcome the next guest on Fresh Air. David Tudor will be along in a few minutes. And I'm still here in the studio with Billy Crystal, the actor and comedian who's going to be appearing at the Bijou Cafe here in Philadelphia through Saturday. One of the things that comes out very clearly in your act is that you grew up in the East,
mm-hmm.
in New York, and now live in Los Angeles. And I speak from personal experience. It's a real shock to go out there. I think it would probably be easier to move to from New York to Budapest than from New York to Los Angeles.
I think you're right. I think you're right. Yeah.
Why is that?
It's an amazing thing. It's a time change. I mean, LA's on leisure time. It's just too relaxed. I mean, Philly too. It's like, Philly is like a small New York, It's great. It's exciting, the city. I mean, it's a very European city too. I drove around this morning and I've been here a number of times but never seen the museum section. It's gorgeous. I mean, you don't have that there. There's a taco section. I mean, there is an avocado section. I mean, there's no center. There's no pulse that radiates out to you or draws you in.
I know. Neil Simon moved out there for maybe 2 years.
And then he's moving back.
He moved back to New York. He didn't know what to write about. He said that he'd have to write about four people in a car.
Yeah, well, the thing is that I think I'm right in saying that's why there are very few, if any, natural-born California comics. Because there's very little adversity. I mean, comedy comes from conflict and adversity, I mean, a natural-born California comic is, what's he going to talk about? Hey, I got up today. God, it was nice. Got in the ocean, 72 degrees, What a rough day. Natural squeeze juices. Look at my tan, huh? Peeling a little bit, watered down. What are they going to do, New York has guts. Philly has guts. There's, striving to do something better, And people, you walk here. You got to drive every place, I don't dig it.
I remember when I was out there, I lived near the a hospital where there are a lot of elderly people. And one guy left one day and approached me on the street, and he was really a mess, and he was had been drinking, and he panhandled. He wanted me to give him some loose change. And I didn't have any, or I was in a hurry or something. I said no, and just kept right on going. And in New York, what somebody would say if you turned them down. If they said anything, it would be, mm-hmm. who the hell do you think you are? Drop mm-hmm. dead or something like this. So I go along, and this guy yells out behind me, "Have a nice day."
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
That struck me as being the essence of the difference. But to the people, when we go out there from the East Coast, we know that they're different from us. How do they experience us as being different from them?
They can't understand why we, why we have so much energy. They can't understand why we're impatient. Or I don't even know if it's impatient. We're waiting for something to happen. Why they can't understand that aggressiveness. They can't understand why if you're online in a supermarket with 15 people and somebody out there is writing a check for a tube of toothpaste for 69 cents and the manager has to okay the check, why people online don't get crazy. I get nuts when that happens. If that happened in New York, they'd squeeze the toothpaste out, squeeze her in and package her and put her in a box someplace. They have no idea of... there's a great absence of hostility, which I find sort of appealing. Here, I like feeling aggressive. It makes you wake up. Makes you live every day.
Yeah, I know a New Yorker out there who some days gets up, and his task for the day is to go out and find an argument.
Yeah.
That's all he does. Well, there's a lot of New York film directors who have made it and have moved out to Los Angeles, and Marty Scorsese is a major example,
mm-hmm.
who just seems to have run out of gas once he gets away from where he's from. Does that kind of thing happen to comics too?
I think I did. I left the East with a great deal of enthusiasm and a wave of popularity starting to grow as a stand-up, and I got there and up until about 4 months ago, I hadn't performed live at all for a year and a half, almost 2 years, because there was no excitement. there was no anything to drive me to go again. You know, I felt very misplaced, felt very alienated out there. And I mean, I was doing real well. The show had happened and the film had come out and I was very hot, but something was missing, you know, and I've just gotten back to it. And oddly enough, most of my touring now, I've selected the East to get those batteries going again.
Yeah.
It's strange, man.
Well, it's we're just about out of time.
Ah.
And I should point out that this is WUHY FM in Philadelphia. And coming up in a few moments, Terry Gross will be here with David Tudor. And I should also remind you that the phone number to call in your tax-deductible pledge to subscribe to WUHY is 243-1234. Or if you live outside the local area code, it's 800-228-5000. And that's toll-free, by the way. I don't know if we've mentioned that, but you can call us absolutely free at 800-228-5000. We're going to be going to a piece of music to close out this portion of the program. And
can I introduce it?
Sure.
In introducing it, I want to say goodbye and thanks for having me. I really had a good time. This is an album that's one of the premiums, I believe. It's a all or nothing and all. It's a composite of some of the great Verve sessions that Billie Holiday did. His Sophisticated Lady, written by Duke Ellington, and features Ben Webster on tenor. See you again.
They say into your early life romance came, and in this heart of yours burned a flame that flickered one day and died away. Then